I'd like to invite David Hamilton to come and speak about his art and his spirituality.
An easy day's journey south of here, there's a magical, musical place. Located on the shore of the Hood Canal, it nestles amid the wooded slopes where once there was a bustling mill town. Today you can stand where the old sawmill used to be and look out over the saltwater mudflats of Seebeck Bay, over a long wooded promontory, and then the foothills, and then the majestic snow-capped Olympic Mountains, which rise in snow-capped majesty and define the hard edge of the sky. This is the home of the Seebeck Conference Center and spiritual home for a lot of UUs, Unitarian Universalists, as they're known in the States, from all over the Pacific Northwest. Their friends and families who come together for week-long camps several times a year. What's interesting to me particularly is there's always a lot of music there. And I've been honored to be the camp accompanist many times since Donna and I and our kids started going there in the mid-80s. Imagine on this occasion, as on many others, the old wooden meeting hall where we all gather is bursting at the seams with 250 souls of all ages, from octogenarians to toddlers. We're singing Spirit of Life, as we just did. I'm playing the piano, and all around me there's a multitude of harmonies arising spontaneously from many lips, and the whole musical outpouring just washes over me and envelops me in a great wave of sound, and my spirit soars with the music. This is sacred time and space, and I'm sure the great Unitarian spirit is glad to receive our joyful sounds. Over the years, I've been fortunate to experience many such moments of grace, in which the music fills my soul, moments of grace that suddenly overwhelm me with a sense of the beauty and wholeness of life. At those times, it's as though I'm in some way connected to all those who have played and sung the piece before. I'm sure the whole atmosphere at Seebeck encourages that, and some of you have been there and know what a magical place it is. But certainly I found many such moments in many other places, including many here at Beacon. Music is a universal form of communication, like mathematics or sculpture or painting, which communicates with us directly, bypassing the barriers imposed by language and entering directly into our hearts and minds and souls. And that's very powerful. Talking of language, by the way, as you're aware, some of my favorite composers, Bach, Brahms, Beethoven, wrote music in German, of course, and it's always a challenge for musicians to play it in English. But luckily, many of them succeed, and so we can enjoy it in our native language. My point is then that it's a universal form of communication, and we don't have to worry about the language barrier. I think there's an essential difference between music and some other forms of artistic expression, like painting, sculpture, and so on, in that those are essentially static. The art form is frozen in time, whereas music is dynamic because you recreate it each time it's performed, and each time it's a little different. I guess that's one reason why I'm attracted to it. I'm not just an observer, but a co-creator with the composer. And I, each time, can feel maybe something a little different about the composer's feelings of isolation or exaltation, success, failure, whatever it is. And that's, again, that's a powerful kind of feeling, that I'm sharing the composer's emotions and hopefully getting it across to people who are listening. How much do I have to work to achieve these moments of grace? A lot. I can listen to others and enjoy the music, and I do that very often with great appreciation for their skill and hard work. But if I want to perform it, I have to work at it. It's akin to a person who wants to achieve enlightenment through meditation. You know, in order to do that, you have to work at meditation a lot. So I've heard. Certainly, musical practice is like that. There are finger strengthening exercises, scales and arpeggios, innumerable studies to be practiced daily if one is a good student. But they're necessary if one is to learn, and only by practice can you improve. Do I hear a refrain from my parents here? Practice makes perfect. And then there are the actual pieces to be worked up and practiced prior to performance. And of course, the learning never ends. Having worked at the piano for a while, it was humbling to take up the cello in late life. As a beginner again, I've got a lot of problems. My hand won't stretch as it should, and as it would have done if I'd been younger. I have to learn where to put my fingers to achieve the right tuning on the notes. I have to strive hard to get that beautiful singing mellow tone out of the instrument, which is what attracted to me in the first place. I have sympathy for those who have to listen to the practicing parts, sounding as I do quite often like an anguished moose, but at least I didn't take up the bagpipes. But despite the challenges, in the end, it is all worth it. It's so very rewarding to make music by myself or especially with others. These moments of grace are worth working for. As Sarah Moores Campbell says, we receive fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight. Let's gather them up for the precious gifts that they are, and renewed by their grace, move boldly into the unknown. Thank you.
In my family, there are lots of artists. My mother was a sculptress. My sister started out as a sculptress and then became a painter. I have an uncle who after retirement, painted landscapes just so beautifully. And I was always the mathematician. I couldn't draw a straight line. I once actually drew a kind of a lake landscape, and my whole family refused to accept that that was my work. They said, you can't, you're a mathematician, you can't draw. So I became a geographer. I became a geographer, and I became a special geographer, something mathematical, something economical. And as such, I got hired to Simon Fraser University because they needed somebody like this, and they couldn't afford a North American because I couldn't bargain for higher salaries. But the first thing that I did was I got into the university, and the chairman showed us around. And as we were walking by the computing center, I said, oh, by the way, two months ago, I took a two-week course in Fortran programming. Fortran programming was the easy language at that time. But those 2 weeks made me the second computer expert in the arts faculty. And I never got away from it. So computer was it. I became one of the pioneers of geographic information systems. But something else happened. One of my first visits that I made was to a friend, actually the friend who got me into Simon Fraser University, and he was in Seattle, and we went to the Ivor Salmon Place. And Ivor Salmon Place is known for good food, and then it surrounded every room except for the bathrooms, is surrounded by native carvings. And I was fascinated by this, because here was an art, and there was not shades of gray, shades of blue, and so on. It was just basically three different units, graphic units. You can see it there on the left, on your left side, the S-curve, the U-shape, and the ovoid. And that's about it. And I thought, and it's put together with so much intelligence that I asked myself, why has the world not accepted the natives as the most intelligent artists in the world? I was fascinated. I talked to the manager, and he said, "Well, here is our menu. Why don't you start with this?" And that became my first carving. I can't remember what it was. I gave it to somebody else. I think somebody in the family, back in Germany, actually. But then I started doing more of that. And I developed a whole box of animals, look, flying, crawling, chirping, and so on. And fortunately, my daughter, who was 15, 16 at the time, needed a topic to work at school. So she put the whole thing together and made a box out of it. And if you visit us, you will enter our by the door and see it immediately. And a lot of people said, "Where did you buy that?" And I said, "I did it myself." but then I saw this drawing by a native, Roy Vickers. And it was the runner. The runner is on the bottom in the center, a man standing in the blocks, ready to run. And I took him and put him into a computer drawing. And then I thought, hey, and I built him up. First, he was there in the blocks, and then he was leaning over, and then he was standing. And you see him standing there. You see him in the blocks, and you see him standing there. I even threw a shadow of his in there. And that was amazing, you know. So I did something else. There was a diver by Roy Vickers. And I took the diver, and he is there just off the board, holding his feet, and I unwrapped him. Where is he? Over there. See there? There he is. First, the first one is him holding his legs, and then slowly unwrapping and falling into the water. And then I was in Mexico teaching for a while, and I liked their triple heads. So I did a triple head. One profile to the left, one profile to the right, a nose and a mouth in between, and here you have a triple head. And I put some native adorations on top, you know, because that's something that the Mexicans don't have. And then I thought, hey, you know, why not develop another box? And so I had two things already the sides actually, you know, with the runner and the triple head, and I had the top, which is the diver, and so I needed a front, and I did the rower over there. One guy in four different positions rowing, you know. The arms are at first stretched and then come closer and closer, and the legs first bent and then get straighter and straighter, and so on. And the lighting is not too good, but so what? You can come closer and this is not, I'm not finished with that, I must admit, you know. Joan just didn't know when to all call me, you know. If she had given me three more years, I would have been finished, you know. So this is what came out of this visit to Ivar Salmon Place. But there's something else, and that is the reaction of the natives. I wrote to Roy Vickers. I sent him some drawing of my work, and so on. And I once got an answer by his manager. He didn't have time to answer. And there was something else. I got to know a fellow who developed the graphics for the Olympics. Remember, there were the main streets had these banners, and there were different sports activities, and you see them here on the right side. You know, the right side has them. I mentioned that to some of the artists, and they didn't know what I was talking about. The lady that was selling native art said, "I don't know what you're talking about." I said, "Lady, you had one of those banners in front of your shop," and she looked at me, turned around, and walked into her office. So why do the natives not look at this? See, when you look at the center part, most of the graphics that the natives produce have about 50 to 100 of these S curves, U shapes, and so on and so on. This one here needs 5 to 9 shapes, and he can do anything he wants. But his name is French. He is from Quebec. He is a white man. He is not a native. I am not a native. And the only thing that keeps me in their good light is that I always say when somebody wants to buy one, I said, "I can't sell this because the natives have the right to sell their stuff and not me." But why don't they accept us as producing something new? You know, why? I promised, literally, I promised Roy Vickers to teach him computer graphics. I spent a week wherever he wants to go and spend and teach him computer graphics. With computer graphics, you can do so much. You can change things, forms, so easily. But I guess there is another group of people that do native art, and they are not natives, and they better not pay, then they better not charge for it. Thank you.
Tom forgot to mention one of his earlier pieces. When I was the active minister here, I mentioned that instead of the cross symbol, perhaps the symbol for Unitarians is the question mark. And so Tom, a month or so later, carved out this platform and this strange-looking curly thing on top of it, and he gave me this Unitarian question mark. I'm sorry I didn't bring it this morning because, well, it's how this artist began, and I'm so impressed with this beautiful stuff here. I don't know what to say except congratulations. I hope it catches. When I was in Peru in the Peace Corps, the activity that was used in art was to take a gourd and burn it to different depths to get a light color, a brown, and a black. And they carved, they depicted all of their life with these gourds. And some of them were used to carry water, but most of them were decorative. And some of the Peace Corps volunteers who had worked in art were from New York, and they decided, well, these are very nice, but let's add some color. And you can buy some of these gourds with different bright colors in them that, like Tom, they were in addition to an art form that was already there, and basically, I think, an improvement in many cases, because colors do add a lot. Anyway, I'm supposed to be talking about poetry. Why poetry? And how in the world can I tie it to spirituality? In an effort to go deeper than common expression, people look to all of the arts, to music, to painting, to dance, to carving, to poetry. Now, poetry must use words, but in using the words, they attempt to stretch beyond dictionary definitions, beyond the limits of logic even. And also, in addition, I feel that poetry has a connection, a human connection, because feelings and fears, dreads and dreams all have human connections. We're not just like an android data. We're not intelligent machines. Where do the poets find their inspiration? I think many poems arrive just like dreams. All of a sudden there's this phrase or this image that you want to capture and do something with. Where that comes from, I don't know, it's just there. And the poet, perhaps like the dream catcher, tries to jot something down very quickly. I remember when I was writing a lot of poetry, I would be walking along and have a pencil in my pocket and a little pad of paper, and if something that I saw, perhaps an iris or something in a garden, caught my eye, and I saw this flower, and this is a connection to something deeper. I would stop and be very rude and not do anything but scribble in my little notebook. Jot it down quickly before it fades and leaves, because these inspirations are like dreams, and they come and they go quickly. We respond to our human lives with basic metaphors, with birth, love, and hope. So what's an example of this? One time, meditating outside under the pines and the oaks, I wrote, "You and I, we too are strummed and sung by the world's winds. We're creatures spun into time and tied to space." restless and rooted, eyeless in Eden's web. Well, you might then wonder, well, who do I say we are? Who are we? I answer, we are beings who love beauty. And also, I believe we are, in a deeper sense, the called ones of creation. And perhaps it just might have something to do with love. At one period in my life, when I was teaching engineering and thinking about some of the things that are based, that engineering is based on, of course, one of them is chemistry, I imagined the forces and motion acting on atoms. And I wondered about the connection between life and these atomic bonds. This is a poem that came to me, and I titled it Love, Covalent Love. The chemistry people out here would know a covalent bond is a particular chemically bond. Anyway, imagine two atoms from empty pasts hurtled toward a single pole. And they're pulled by forces they don't know anything about. They're pulled by forces they know nothing of, past others, singles and in pairs, past occasional weird ions that charge about, warping the regular roof of space. Their electrons hang on like kids in the rumble seat, probabilities waving to other passers-by. Now and again, a photon flashes past, almost too fast to display her charms. Next, a near miss with an enormous snake-like carbon train forces a slight change in our atom's path. Still, the vibrant pair race on. In a Genesis Eve, as photons make light over a field of singing spheres. Now, the tickling fingers of a tantalizing new force turns their heads, changes their courses. They go into a dizzying spiral, an ever closer heavenly curve. Geometrically, their mutual attraction grows. At last, they can come no closer. Excited electrons orbit the both of them, bonding them tightly as their inner shells touch. Such bliss. They have become one, a new molecule, married by the laws of the universe. At another time, I was out probably on a hike with a group in California. I was at a park sitting by a stream, and I noticed a little bug crawling around in the pebbles. And it pebbles right near the water flowing, and on the other side there was a bank and nice green grass. And I thought, well, gee, it would probably want to go that way. But it couldn't quite make up its mind. It seemed like it was going in circles. I wondered, what was its problems? And I took a closer look. Could I help it? Well, Joan can help it, because this is the poem I wrote about a minor god being people ponder the problems of communication.
A minor god ponders the problem of communication. Alone over irregular rocks, a five-legged beetle scrabbles towards the river's rapids and away from the grassy ground. An insect Sisyphus, our wrong way Corrigan, too short to see over the shale, struggles on into a rock slide of repetitive challenges, endless effort, and no nourishment, generally making a mess of its afternoon. I watched, unamused, unable to share my lofty perspective, unable to say it should turn around. What sound would be understood? My language echoes back. My goodwill rebounds too. Both fail to find the little black head, the little black heart. Only direct intervention, only a miracle seen from the cockroach perspective, could save this impudent insect. I cannot enlighten this low life. Such limits stagger me. I look up to see gray mountains far away. How dare I hope to be heard by the elevated? How dare I hope to hear them?
Why is it so hard? We ask for direct words in our own language, or physical miracles like a divine omniscient finger to flick this impudent black beetle off of its rocks and into the safety of the green grass nearby. But how to reach the Creator? And why should the real God care to answer us? I like to begin at the beginning. I like to go to a place more basic that there can't be anything under it. At the opening of the Gospel of John is this little daring bit of hubris. John says that before anything was created to make up the world as we sense it was this. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. Well, that's interesting. That's not the Big Bang. That's an idea. And I always thought that John was onto something, but I wasn't quite sure what this word was. When I write, I like to get in touch with my senses. I like to, what I can see, hear, smell, taste, touch. Like a good Unitarian, I don't like to take someone else's beliefs that I can't check out myself by my senses. So I mostly write about stuff that I can sense or experience. This last poem came from meeting a bird. It's a true story, and Joan has the words.
Stellar's Jay. On the long, low arm of the cedar, he sat, blue, oh my, so brilliantly blue. And under his black tri-cornered hat, a sharp, hook-tipped nib and inky eyes of dew. In the low dress circle of the cedar, he settled, while I sang from my seat mid the tall meadow grass. I crooned folk tunes. My guitar twanging metal rang out for sunshine, snowbirds, things of that class. We watched him close, my friend and I. We watched, and I sang till the cool shadows came, fixed by this fresh-washed wonder from the sky that paused for the music, as if waiting out a rain. The exchange was even on all sides of the trade, for us, for the jay, and for the joy of being there. With no coins in common, I know we were all overpaid just by seeing and being in that crisp mountain air. And later, when sun brushed the tops of all the tall sugar pines and the chill of twilight began to fill the lea, another jay landed and lured him to his kind. And we stared at the low, empty branch of the tree. If someone asks me what I did that day to pleasure God, I'll say I touched the beauty of a very stellar bird. I'll say I learned that holy stuff isn't all that odd. A song, a jay, an afternoon, and an answer to the word.
An answer to the word. Back to the basic question, where are we? We are somewhere between our bodies and our feelings and our souls. It's time to close. I have closed with this blessing May the gummy little smiles of happy babies, may the wet nose wriggling, jumping joy of a Cavalier Spaniel puppy, may the shining-eyed kiss from your first true love, may all the technical wonders of a brilliant sunsets be yours now and every day for the rest of your life. Amen.